Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Okay, welcome, folks, to the Gangland Wire Crime Stories Podcast. This is your host, Gary Jenkins, and I want you to know I have a special guest for you mob fans tonight. I expect most of you, or a lot of you, know about retired FBI agent Bill Owsley. He was interviewed, and he was really the anchor, my Shelby Foote, shall we say, and storyteller in my film Gangland Wire. And he's written two books. One is Open City. Open City is about the mafia in Kansas City from the turn of the century on up until around the 50s. And then his second book is Mobsters in Our Midst, and you can get both of those on Amazon. But first, as usual, we're down in the deep, dark confines of the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And remember, go to www.bigdumbfunshow.com on Monday night to hear Aaron's show live. All right, my friend Aaron Ganerk is here. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
You want to tell your folks a little bit about your show and your new project, Sarcasm Cinema?
Well, I could tell them about Big Dumb Fun Show, which, of course, is a trending topics, drive time cell talk, independent unsigned music radio television program. And then we've been doing a Sunday night special program called Sarcasm Cinema, where we make fun of good movies, generally.
Good movies. He had me come in and try to make fun of No Country for Old Men, but I'm not that funny. He and his friends are funny.
Well, but you had personal experience that was relevant to the movie, so I thought that was fitting.
Yeah, that's true.
And you, of course, your background being in the Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit.
Yeah.
For 25 years.
You're right.
25 years.
But now I'm a lawyer and a filmmaker and a podcaster.
And a podcaster.
Podcaster and an app developer.
That's right.
Don't forget about my app, folks. If you like Kansas City mob history, download, go to your app store, Google Play or iTunes, and download a Kansas City Mob Tours, and you can take your own self-guided tour of mob sites in Kansas City, starting from the 30s, clear up to the 80s.
Now, interestingly enough, when we do these podcasts and we talk about various events, historic or more current, through the course of the conversation, frequently we come up with new locations that should be added to the app.
Correct. Here's one. 85th and Troost. It was the site of the Old Fortress Lounge, which was owned by the guy we're going to talk about tonight, and it's now BB's Loneside Barbecue. So I probably ought to put that in there.
You should.
I'm sure. What's the guy's name that owns BB's? I can't remember his name all of a sudden. I know it. He's a blues guy. I should stop out there and tell him about that.
That actually isn't a location.
Yeah.
That's historically.
Yeah. Maybe I could get him to sponsor me. Maybe he'd buy an ad on my
on
app.
Your app.
Yeah. Anyhow, so having said all that, let's just get started tonight. We're going to talk about a man by the name of James Salvatore Duarte, or Jimmy Duarte. And my first contact with Jimmy Duarte was in 1976. I had just gone to the intelligence unit, and a friend of mine named Bobby Arnold had just gotten into the intelligence unit. And Jimmy Duarte was in prison at Leavenworth for the case we're going to talk about tonight. It's a really interesting case. He and some other fellows tried to take over all of northwest Oklahoma, practically, or at least the Grand Lake area, and open it up for narcotics and prostitution. And not narcotics, I mean gambling and prostitution. He was up at Leavenworth, and Bobby Arnold had seen a picture of him on the wall. We had many pictures of mob guys on the wall, just so we'd stay familiar with them. And And he came back in the office one afternoon and told the older guys who were working there, he said, you know, I think I saw that Jimmy Duarte. You know, Bobby was brand new, and he didn't really know who Jimmy Duarte was, and I didn't either. And they all hooted him down and said, oh, you couldn't have seen Jimmy Duarte. You don't know anything. He's in jail up in Leavenworth. So Bobby was pretty sure that was Jimmy Duarte he saw, and he called up to Leavenworth and talked to somebody, and he found out that Jimmy Duarte was his job was at the prison farm up there, the minimum security facility, and that job was to drive a truck, a bread truck, into Kansas City to pick up bread supplies for the prison. So the guard told him, said that could have been Jimmy Duarte down there at Kansas City that day. It probably was. So Bobby was redeemed, and that kind of started Bobby and I into looking into the activities of James S. Duarte. But first, we need to know a little bit about his past, and talking to other Sergeant Wisher and some of the other people around there, Ray Kinney. We learned that Jimmy Duarte was kind of a mobster from the old school. He had this personality that was bigger than life. He could be just real likable, but he was a deadly killer too. He was a nephew of a guy named Gaetano Lococo, who was an old-time mafia leader during Prohibition. Bill, can you say anything about that relationship between Gaetano and Jimmy Duarte?
Well, those type of relationships, when it comes to the Cosa Nostra family, are exceedingly important. Lococo was a founder of the family here, goes way back to the very beginnings, lived to almost 100, and was respected all those years. Although he was pretty inactive in those later years, he was still considered a very important man because of the history. So Duarte rode those coattails, and it's a form of protection and an opportunity.
Yeah, It's all about family, and more than one definition of family in this sense. You know, I remember one time I was downtown. I saw Filardo. I can't remember what's his first name.
Joe Filardo
and Gaetano Lococo together, and they had parked their car and they were going into one of the downtown office buildings. I think it was a Lather building. It was still occupied. And so I just pulled over and I got out of my car and I walked up and just walked next to them into the lobby and they got on the elevator. So I got on the elevator with them and I was marveled. I mean, I was in awe. These two guys were like these two little old 4'11", 5'1", dried up old men who, you know, these were the most feared mobsters in Kansas City at one point in time, and now it was like you could just reach over and break their neck with your fingers almost. They were so frail and old, and I followed them up, and they got off on the floor, and I went on back down, and it was always kind of, I don't know, it was eye-opening to me to stand that close to these huge mafia giants out of the 30s and 40s. But anyhow, I digress.
Were you hoping to catch a bit of conversation from them?
Oh, you know, I knew they wouldn't say anything. I just wanted to stand right next to them and see what they really look like up close rather than a block in front of me in a car or as I drive by or something. That was the main thing.
Do you think they got recognized often as they went around Kansas City?
No. Nobody knew. By then, this is in the 70s. Nobody knew who they were, except people who were in life. You know, people who were in life knew who they were and gave them the respect that they had earned back in the day when they were the feared mobsters in Kansas City. But so Duarte was, you know, Bill, what do you think about this? I read somewhere where he was suspected of taking part in the murder of the two Charlies, that famous murder where Charlie Gargatta and Charlie Bonaggio had taken a lot of money and promised to guarantee an open city and a police board that would be amenable to gambling and not do a lot of gambling raids and prostitution too, and they didn't get it done, and they'd reneged on those promises, the politicians had reneged on their promises, and two Charlies taking a lot of money, and they ended up dead over here at the North End Democratic Club on Truman Road. Yeah. What do you think about that? Do you think he had anything to do with that?
From the intelligence that in my history research, Duarte, I don't think, was a part of that crew that killed Charlie's. Now, Duarte was involved in another murder of a fella here. I don't remember the name or anything, and I think that's why he fled to go to California and live there.
He did go to California. I found that out.
Yeah, but not. I don't think he was part of the Bonaggio assassination.
What about Nick Civella? Was he part of that?
Well, Nick Civella, from what I could put together, because a lot of this is lost in history. There were no intelligence units. There were no FBI organized crime squads. There were some policemen that were very knowledgeable, but nothing went on paper.
When did they first organize those?
Intelligence?
What's that?
Yeah,
intelligence. After the Appalachian Convention of 1957.
Okay.
When they were all caught, the Brotherhood leadership of Cosa Nostra were convening in a little town in Appalachian, New York. It was broken up by the state police, and that changed the whole world of organized crime.
And the police tactics.
And now, well, after that, there wasn't this ability to hide the fact that there's such an organization, and everybody had to respond. The politicians, the media, law enforcement, government, and that got the ball rolling, and intelligence units started to perform. Hoover formed the organized crime program, and legislators started looking into laws and what have you. Prior to that, they had a free run.
And Nick Civella was there at that convention with all the big Eastern mobsters.
Right.
And this Joe Filardo.
Right. They were the representatives at that meeting.
For Kansas City.
Kansas City. As I've written in my book, I make it brief, Civella appears to be the orchestrator of the Bonaggio Gargatta murder as the then boss, Tony Gizzo's right-hand man. Civella was smarter than Gizzo, cleverer than Gizzo, and to discern was he orchestrated it, and that's how he made his bones, so to speak. And when Gizzo died, who becomes the boss? Nick Civella. What did he do to earn that? He orchestrated that murder, and that put him on the top of the heap.
Yeah, that makes sense. Anyhow, when Duarte came back out of jail, and I don't know much about his activities before the Oklahoma situation, but I do know that when I first started looking at him in 1976, he seemed to operate, say, south of 75th Street here in Kansas City, south of the Waldo area. You never saw him up in the North End, or very rarely. You might see him in the City Market once in a while, but very rarely did you see him up at the Trap or on Independence Avenue at the Villa Capri. I don't ever hardly remember seeing him except stopping in at the market once in a while. And so he seemed to command a certain presence out south. And his club, of course, was the Old Fortress at 85th and Troost, down underneath just west of Troost. 1205 East 85th. I got to put it in my app.
Right.
I know.
Put that in your app. BB's Lawn and Barbecue.
Lindsey Shannon, look out. That's the guy that owns BB's Lawn Side Barbecue. So, but he seemed to, what do you think about that, Bill? I mean, was he like given that as a territory or?
Well, that's the commonly accepted story on the street. Prior to that, Duarte really, I would have to say, didn't have a great prominence. He operated not high on the radar. We all knew who he was, and of course the Lococo connection and what have you. But and he was down at City Market a lot, he was friendly with car dealers, which became one of his main things, getting involved in car operations. But I think he was doing what he did later, and that is finding his way into businesses. Another way of saying he took them over or infiltrated himself in such a way that it made offers you couldn't refuse. But it, in the later years, it appeared that he moved out south and was given that territory.
So in early 70s, he and a man named Nate Brancato and Cliff Bishop from Kansas City got involved in expanding mob activities down into northeast Oklahoma, into the Grand Lake area. Now, folks, the Grand Lake area, if you're not familiar with it, is it's kind of like the Lake of the Ozarks or a large lake that had vacation houses on it. It had motels around it. There were clubs. There was fishing and water skiing. And I know my wife, her uncle was a dentist in Wichita, and he had a vacation home. And they would drive down from Kansas City and meet her cousins and share the house and go water skiing quite every other weekend or so all summer. So it was a hopping area from a resort standpoint at that point in time. You'd have it really close to Tulsa and Kansas City and probably people came over from Little Rock even, and this was kind of, this was just as Table Rock was forming, and it wasn't being a Corps of Engineer lake, it wasn't as hopping because you couldn't build right up on the lake, and Grand Lake, I believe, was more like the Lake of the Ozarks. So it was a hopping deal, and I know they felt like, I think at one time, they kind of owned that county. They had some of the law enforcement people in their pocket and all a bunch of the club owners. So, Bill, Nate Brancato, he and his family own Fairland, and they still have a catering company today. And I just, as I studied this when I was a young intelligence officer, I never understood quite the connection with Nate Brancato and Jimmy Duarte. He didn't have that background. The family didn't have that kind of background. It didn't appear to me like. But what do you think about that, Bill?
Well, I think Brancato and his operation are the type of things that Duarte would attach himself to. The Brancatos certainly were known to many of these people in the organization, and it just struck me, again, it's never been truly explained. These people don't talk when they're indicted, so we don't get a lot of that story. But it appears to me it was a business that Duarte became associated with in some form, and Brancato was open to this proposition of moving down to northeast Oklahoma and being part of this conspiracy.
Of course, the Brancatos were in the entertainment business anyhow, and they knew a lot about it. And so,
right, catering so, and what have you. Right. And according to the case that eventually came out of their efforts in Grove, Oklahoma, which was the little city down there, the government, in its pleadings, identified Brancato as the finance man. He was the person who would be able to get bank loans, make political connections, and produce money when it was needed. You know, that's the best I can recall as to what the government was ready to prove in court. So that must have been really Nate's position as the finance guy.
Yeah, he was probably more like the legitimate business guy to him, that as they introduced themselves to people, this Jess Roberts and the Mr. Yuck Club, which was, there was a club down there. The Mr. Yuck Club was kind of the central, key place down there that they moved in. They formed an alliance with this Jess Roberts to, and he was going to have gambling in there, and I assume Duarte was going to get a little piece of the action, and they were supposed to keep the political people to have them lined up to keep law enforcement off of them. They kept getting raided, and there was a district attorney down there named Grayson.
Frank Grayson.
Frank, district attorney down there named Frank Grayson, and he got caught up in this. Can you tell me a little bit about, tell us a little bit about that, Bill?
To begin with, these predators have a way of smelling blood in the water, and I think they got on to Jess Roberts because he was having an enormous amount of problem. He built the Yuck Club in 1971, August, $150,000 investment. He claims that he went to see Frank Grayson to say, how do I operate my club with the liquor by the drink so I'm okay? And Grayson supposedly told him how to do it, so he went around, went ahead and built the place, as I say, $150,000. he also had a Mr. Yuck Club of interest in Lawrence, Kansas, which also was doing very well. Within a three-month period after he opened the club, he was raided four times. He was in trouble. Now, whether these raids were orchestrated by the mob, we don't have that connection, but it's the kind of thing they can do with a quirky DA. But anyway...
you mean like they provide a tip and the DA goes, well, we're going to follow up on this tip because it's so credible.
You know, it's the old story of what they used to call the labor consultant in the mob. they send a guy in to create all the trouble. They steal stuff and what have you. And then the labor consultant comes in and said, you know, I can clean that up. And, of course, they can clean it up in 3 minutes because the guy causing it is their person. Well, if you have a crooked DA, you can work with him. We'll put pressure on this guy, then we'll move in on him. Now, whether that happened or not, I don't know. Grayson claimed he was just not operating properly and he was getting pressure from outside to do something about this guy. But anyway, it was convenient that enter the picture Cliff Bishop, Duarte's man, and he's introduced as a guy who can help you out when you have a lot of trouble. And that was the beginning of their infiltration. Thereafter, they invited him to Kansas City on the promise of a vending venture and expanded from there into their plans to turn the club into a prostitution gambling operation. And the agreement was that they could only do it. They all were in agreement that we're going to have to bribe some people.
So that then, I mean, that's perfect. I mean, he has a lot of trouble, and then Duarte sends Bishop in, and they say, hey, I got a connection in Kansas City, a big-time mafia connection, can help you with this. And then he's got political connections, so we'll solve all your trouble. I mean, that's...
we'll solve all your trouble, but you want me to turn it into a prostitution establishment?
well, yeah.
And gambling, which would be illegal?
Yeah.
But, you know, Jess Roberts is not Mr. Pure here. He had to say, yeah, I'm interested.
Sure.
And he was. He was interested. And it lends credence somewhat to the corrupt situation in Northeast Oklahoma at that time. In fact, an Oklahoma grand jury in Oklahoma City was looking into political corruption. So it wasn't, it was a seedy operation down there.
So, and then Jack Michael King. I see here that King had a club down there called the Showboat Club at the same time, and he ended up falling in with Duarte and involved with this deal too. He was he ended up working with Duarte over the next several years. We kept running into him time after time. We even had some had a couple of professional thieves that Gene Maggio and Michael Cattu that moved to Tulsa. And we happened to see them loading up and heading south, and we followed them quite a ways, and then we got a hold of intelligence people down at Tulsa, and they picked them up when they got to Tulsa. We got them down to I-44, and it looked like they were probably going to Tulsa, and we went on back, and they picked them up and set them down, and they moved down there, and they were hooked up with Jack Michael King, and he was a Cherokee Indian, and he was hand in glove in all this deal. Sometimes it's hard to figure out who the players are and what they are, who does what. But he got involved in it too. He was a really interesting guy.
Well, you know, King was brought into the deal, and as another person to corroborate the importance of Brancato, Duarte, and Bishop. And he comes in and he says, hey, I've known these guys, and they've helped me out in the past in my club. And he said, you know what? In return for all the help they gave me, I gave Bishop a piece of my business. And unbelievably, during this meeting where they're discussing what they're going to do, Jess Roberts says, well, to show my good faith, I'm going to give Duarte a piece of the Mr. Yuck Club. So this is how these mob guys operate. At times, it's, you know, you think they're going to come in with machine guns and what have you, but the power of who they are and the promise of what they're going to do, and of course a willing accomplice, and now they're in as partners in a club, and they've invested nothing.
Yeah, I think in the case it indicated that Duarte was going to get 20% of that club, they also talked to discuss other financing through the Bureau of Indian Affairs and trying to get more money into the club. It was, you know, they were working every angle that they could.
Yeah, that was interesting. Duarte had a relationship going back into the 40s with the wife. Well, he knew the chief of the of this tribe down there.
I think it was the Cherokees.
Cherokee tribe, and her name was Olivia Pitts. And so to complete this orchestration and this drama, they dragged Jess Roberts in to meet Olivia Pitts, the wife of the chief, and he's deceased now. And she says, oh, I've known Duarte since 46, and we can do magic down here. I will get you an SBA loan or an Indian Affairs loan for $200,000. Jimmy and I can do that. Well, you know, Roberts is taking this all in, and I think it's all part of the plot to cement him in to this operation.
To gain his confidence.
Yeah, his confidence and his reliance. I'm relying on his, yeah. Because as a sidelight, when financing became an issue, Jess Roberts went to his banker. He had a $70,000 loan at the First National Bank of Miami. And so he knew the guy, and he was, this will show you how Miami County and all was operating. He went to his banker and said initially, before this second meeting, and he says, hey, I'm getting raided. What can I do to help myself? And the guy says, hey, I'll get back to you. Now, this is the vice president of the bank.
Yeah.
He gets back to him and he says, you're going to have to pay bribes. The sheriff, a guy named Roselle, he's needing $1,200 to buy a car. And he said, for $1,200, this may go away. Now, this is the vice president
of the bank.
The freaking bank.
God.
And so Roberts, who says, I'm not paying $1,200. So anyway, that dies. Now, later, he goes back to him because he's needing money. And he said, I need $40,000. The Pitts deal is in the work. He doesn't know. They need money. So the guy says, you've been raided so many times. You're not a good risk. I'm not paying for it. I'm not giving you the loan.
Sure.
Okay. Subsequently, the vice president's father, who is the president of the bank, now he disclaims, I didn't know anything about the initial $40,000 or anything that went on. But, you know, I just happened to be talking to Frank Grayson. And Frank Grayson just happened to tell me, you know, you could go ahead and make that $40,000 loan because it looks like things have cleared up. And what the banker didn't know is just prior to that, Jess Roberts had gone to Grayson through his investigator, a guy named Hugh Song, who was the go-between, and Hugh Song had said, we'll take care of it for money. 20% of the gambling and a car for the sheriff. So the thing had been worked out, and lo and behold, the president is told, you can go ahead and make that loan now. Things look okay. So this is...
And the bank made the loan.
No, I didn't never made the loan, but that's indicative of the climate down there. The climate was perfect for these guys.
So something happened, though. Jess Roberts got cold feet.
Yeah. Jess Roberts eventually got cold feet. Now, I don't remember, to tell you the truth, the whole story. So on the night of March 19th, Jack King asked Roberts to meet him out on a deserted highway outside of a grove. And he was leaning against King's car, and they were talking when Bishop came out of the bushes nearby and shotgunned him, knocking him to the floor. Then he shotgunned him twice more.
Shotgunned which guy?
Jess Roberts.
Jess Roberts.
Threw him in the trunk of the car, and then they drove further out into the woods and dumped him in a ditch. Unbelievably, Jess Roberts was not dead. So he wanders in this netherland and unfortunately runs into somebody. They take him to the Grove Hospital, and he gets there at about 1 o'clock, and he survives the shooting. Interestingly enough, Husong, the investigator for Grayson, who was the go-between, he calls a narcotics agent in Kansas City prior to Jess Roberts arriving at the hospital and tells him Roberts has been shot and left for dead by unknown assailants. Now, how did he know that Jess Roberts... He hadn't gotten to the hospital yet. Well, this was some of the information used...
The guys that shot him reported it to him.
Yeah.
So I guess he knew.
Maybe so.
I guess he knew, or he was part of the plot to shoot him from the get-go. And that's what the government alleged. He was complicit in the murder. Yeah. But anyway, Jess survives the shooting and becomes cooperative when approached by the Bureau agents. And that was the nexus of the prosecution that took place later.
Okay, we're a little over 30 minutes now. Let's wind this down, and next time we're going to talk about this prosecution because it had some unusual twists, too. First call. Make first call your first call when you have an employee, a loved one, a friend who has a problem with addiction. Call 816-361-5900 or go to www.firstcall.com. www.firstcallkc.com. And they have a Facebook page, too. Which is First Call. Just type in First Call.
And Facebook, and you'll find them there.
Or Google. So anyhow, they're my favorite nonprofit, and I like to give them a little plug each time we do one of these.
And then remember to download the app.
Yeah, don't forget to download the app and subscribe to the podcast. Give me a review. Go to iTunes. Now, you can't, I just learned this. I'm trying to deal with iTunes now. You can't search in iTunes, and their search mechanism will not find Gangland Wire crime stories. I don't know why yet. I've sent 2 or 3 emails to them, and they keep telling me I'm at the wrong place. But I think I finally got the right one the other day.
Do you have a link that you can put on your website to the iTunes?
I have a link. I just put a link. Go to www.ganglandwire.com and go to the podcast page, and there's a link to go to the,
iTunes
page.
Account.
Right. Or you can just Google Gangland Wire Crime Stories, iTunes, and that'll take you to it also. So I think that's about all for this evening. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Goodnight, Gary. And remember to buy the movie Gangland Wire, available on DVD through ganglandwire.com, or you can watch it on Amazon. Although we'd rather have you buy the DVD. Gary will autograph a copy and send it to you.
That's correct.
And Bill, he's got a couple books.
He does. Bob, I forgot. Aaron, you're always on that. Bill?
Well, if you're interested in
mob
history in Kansas City from 1900 almost to 1985, 86, 87, at the end of the Savella regime here. The two books are Open City, The Kansas City Crime Family from 1900 1950, or Mobsters in Our Midst, The Kansas City Crime Family.
Well, folks, download the podcast and let us know what you think of them.
And go to Amazon for Bill's books.
That's right. Until the next episode, this is Gangland Wire, Crime Stories with Gary Jenkins.